This week on Behind the Lens. Water pressure problems have led the Orleans Parish School Board to cancel plans to install microbe-removing filters on school drinking fountains. Marta Jusen has the latest. And the New Orleans City Council has announced steps to reduce its use of outside consultants for energy regulation. Michael Isaac Stein explains. Also, Mississippi River water diverted through the Bonnet Carey spillway is wreaking havoc on Gulf Coast ecosystems. I'll talk with the mayor of Waveland, Mississippi, Mike Smith. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
Last summer, the Orleans Parish School Board began installing lead and microbe-removing water filters at all city schools. That project was delayed because water pressure in many school buildings wasn't adequate enough for the filters to work properly. Now, the OPSB is changing course. Marta Jusen is here with the latest. Marta, remind us what prompted the Orleans Parish School Board to install these lead and microbe-removing water filters at city schools in the first place.
So we actually go all the way back to July of 2016 for this. That's when officials were indicted in Flint, Michigan for their lead and water crisis. And district officials took it upon themselves, both OPSB and RSD. They said they were going to test the water. And we kind of went from there. They eventually decided not to test the water. They thought that was going to be too expensive. And they thought filters were going to be a safer way to go in the end game. But those filters didn't start going in until 2 years later. And now we are where we are, which is that we've got filters hooked up at some schools, but not at others.
And they bypassed the testing because it would be expensive and just kind of assumed, based on the age of the school buildings and the age of the pipes, that it's a safe bet to just install these filters.
Right. And the other variable there is what's happening outside the city schools, right? So the Sewer and Water Board, if they are performing lead pipe replacements down the street from a school, that could expose schools and homes if it's knocking lead particles loose in the pipes. So they thought, yep, overall, this would just be a safer move to make.
Through your reporting, you uncovered this water pressure problem, basically that the pressure wasn't adequate to push the water through the filters at the right speed. And if the filters were going to work properly, schools needed booster pumps.
Right, so we kind of slowly uncovered this issue through emails and other various reporting sources, people that we talked to. And what was interesting about it is that they've known about this issue since September. And when they did start installing the filters in August, we noticed it was going kind of slow, right? And they seemed to keep being behind and behind on their schedule. They said they'd have 30 schools done by the end of 2018. They didn't make that goal. Things kept being pushed back farther and farther. And we wanted to know why this was happening. Why is this being delayed? Like, clearly there's got to be something systemic going on if it's taking so long to do. So we requested a bunch of emails that requesting any information about low water pressure because we had heard that from one school. Actually, it was Plessy, which we've talked about before, where the student did his own water test. And they're the ones who had to have booster pumps put in so they would work there. And then we were like, oh, if they're doing it at Plessy, maybe they're doing it everywhere. And it turns out that was a problem at a lot of their schools.
Part of the delay was that schools needed booster pumps. And then you had some evidence last month that filters at some schools weren't even connected. And now you're hearing about issues that were being caused by the booster pumps.
Right, issues caused by the filters. Because the filters were what was slowing down the water. And they needed the booster pumps to make sure they had an appropriate arc of water and make sure they had water coming out of the fountains. So yes, the filters were not, even though they were installed, they were not hooked up at all of the schools. I think this could have potentially been a little misleading to parents and school staff who saw those filters like installed above their drinking fountains and maybe didn't know that they weren't connected. But some of them weren't connected and some of them might still not be connected to this day. So that's been an interesting part of this. And then just recently we learned the district told us that the booster pumps could indeed potentially cause damage to the drinking fountains themselves if they're putting out water at too high of a pressure. And that's a new development for us. We don't know a whole lot else about that, but it appears like it could be an equipment issue.
So in a sense, the filters that were put in for lead and microbe removal need a higher water pressure than perhaps the water fountains can even safely sort of maintain.
Right. And so especially in older buildings where there's just lower water pressure because they don't have what's called a domestic booster pump, which is like at the entrance of the school, of the water line, giving more water flow to the school in general. So at our older schools, we are seeing that issue more frequently. And yes, there are two different kinds of filters in the system. There's one for lead and there's one for the microbes. So what they realized is that the microbe one needed a higher water pressure to work.
So what have they decided?
Well, back in September, they questioned this and they thought maybe we can just get rid of the microbe filters. You know, lead is why we started in the first place. And one of the other officials who had been asked that question said, you know, I don't know if we can take that off because that was part of the bidding contract and they'd had contract issues in the past. But lo and behold, they've decided to do that anyways. So it sounds to me like they're going to just remove the microbe filter out of this three-part system and they're just going to augment the filters so that they now remove lead. So in these filter boxes, these stainless steel boxes, there are three different filters, one for sediment, one for lead, and one for microbes. And the impression that I'm getting is that they're just going to take out the microbe filter in these stainless steel boxes.
And that's the one that needed the higher pressure.
Correct.
So we talked about this last time, that the need for additional water pressure just for these microbe filters, that really the microbe filters are for when there are boil advisories, when Sewerage and Water Board cannot guarantee the safety of the water in the system. And we know that happens occasionally, you know, too frequently in this town, some would say. But ultimately, what schools were concerned about is lead. So it seems like there's been a long delay for, you know, an extra filter when really the main concern was potential lead in school drinking water.
Exactly. And I talked to an advocate today, Gail Fendley of Lead Safe Louisiana, who, you know, she said the exact same thing. She said, you know, this has been delayed far, far too long. And the fact that that we didn't see this problem coming with the microbe filters is, you know, is an issue. And she just hopes they can get this project and the lead filters in as fast as they can.
So it's the late middle of June. School starts up again in August. What does the timeline look like?
The last time we talked to the district, this was maybe like 3 or 4 weeks ago, about this issue, they had told us that they had set a goal of August 1st to have all the filters in. So it sounds like they're working hard to meet that, and hopefully our kids have filters in their schools when they get back in the fall.
Marta Jusen, thanks for staying on top of this.
Thank you.
The Utility Committee of the New Orleans City Council announced a plan to change the way that Entergy is regulated, shifting responsibility from paid outside contractors to inside staff. Michael Isaac Stein has been following the story. Michael, thanks for joining me. How does regulation of Entergy work here in New Orleans?
In almost the entire country, power companies, utilities, are regulated at the state or regional level. But New Orleans is one of the few that has local control over regulating their local power company, Entergy New Orleans. So the city has a regulatory office, the Council Utilities Regulatory Office, that's responsible for that. And basically, the council has power over a wide range of what Entergy can do, how much it can charge its customers. You know, they were responsible for, you know, deciding whether Entergy could build this new power plant or not. So a lot of control over what Entergy can do.
And you've written before about how New Orleans does this regulation differently from most other cities. Why do we do it differently?
Yeah, so what really sets New Orleans apart is that most regulatory bodies, they have, you know, pretty large staffs. So the Louisiana Public Service Commission, for example, I mean, they have nearly 100 employees. The Curo office here has had two or less employees for decades now. And we rely almost entirely on these out-of-town consultants to do this regulatory work. You know, what else sets the city apart and why regulation can be a little bit more challenging here is that, you know, for a public service commission, people are elected specifically for utility regulation. When in New Orleans, city council members, for the most part, are not, you know, elected based on their, you know, utility regulation bona fides, right? So there's just this pretty massive lack of expertise for a very complex issue, especially when you're going up against Entergy's team of lawyers. So that's really set us apart. The other thing that sticks out is the fact that those utility consultants have been, you know, pretty much the same group of people for about 30 years. Earlier this year, we released a pretty lengthy report on how, you know, many people had told us that they had been able to sustain these contracts for so many years through kind of political contributions and connections. But yeah, again, the real point to take away here is that we use almost entirely consultants to do this regulatory work, something that no other regulatory body does.
And what kind of price tag does this consultant arrangement come with?
Right. So it's anywhere between $6 or $7 million a year, by far the largest contracts given out by the city council. And those costs, the consultants bill to Entergy, but Entergy ultimately passes those costs on to their customers. So everyone who gets, you know, a monthly bill from Entergy, these costs are built into that.
So let me get that straight. The city council enters into these contracts for these consultants, millions of dollars. And Entergy customers, those of us living in New Orleans who pay our electric bills, are paying for the consultants.
Right. So, I mean, the general idea is that, you know, the city council, basically that Entergy should be paying for its own regulation. But again, what ends up happening is that customers do kind of bear the brunt of that.
So if the city council has a contract with this consulting firm, where does the oversight of the consulting firm come in?
So oversight lies with the council. But one problem that has been discussed before and that we've written about is that, you know, I keep on talking about what sets New Orleans apart, but here's another very strange thing. I mean, every utility regulator, they have certain amounts of consultants that they'll bring on for specialized work. You know, maybe there's litigation at the federal level that, you know, your local lawyers aren't used to, so you bring in a consultant. Our consultant contracts are very strange because they're these 1-year general advisory contracts. So basically it says you are our utility advisors for the next year, and you can bill us up to this amount. So there's not a lot of direction from the council in terms of you're working on this project and you can use this amount of hours to bill us. It's more of just a general advisory role. And again, that has left some people questioning whether there is the proper oversight over how much we're getting billed.
And, you know, if there's questions about oversight, there's also probably plenty of room for potential conflicts of interest.
Yeah, that's something else we had written about before. The most recent, you know, conflict that we saw, current council member Jay Banks had worked for one of our consultants, Legend Consulting, a Denver-based firm. He was a government liaison for them from 2013 to 2017, right before he started running for city council. And I think some people would argue whether these are conflicts or not, just to be clear. But another potential conflict that we saw was Karen Carter Peterson, who is the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. She is an attorney with Dentons, who is our legal utility consultant. So some people have pointed to that as a potential conflict as well. And if you go back and read over the last 30 years, these conflicts have been written about over and over. If you go back to the Times Pick archives, you know, you can see that, you know, every few years someone writes about a conflict between the council and these utility advisors, whether they be contributions, personal relationships, someone who has, you know, a business, you know, with one of the consultants separately from their role in the council. So it's been a pretty consistent theme.
And so this regulation and contractor issue regarding Entergy is something that Councilwoman Helena Moreno has spoken about before. What happened this week at the Utility Committee meeting?
Yeah, so a couple months back, Councilmember Moreno, who is the chair of the Utility Committee, basically announced her intention to start growing in-house expertise and cutting down on these consultant contracts. And, you know, in her first year in this position, she was able to grow the office from 2 employees to 5. So the head of the Council Utilities Regulatory Office, Aaron Spears, came to present about basically looking forward how Moreno's, you know, intent to change the structure of this regulation, how it'll actually be done. So for the first time, we got some concrete plans. So the first big one is that they're going to double the size of the staff from 5 to 10. And, you know, they said this could take anywhere from, you know, 1 to 2 years. And part of that, just to explain why this might take so long, is that creating a new government position, a salaried position, is actually a pretty tough process. You have to go through the Civil Service Commission. You need to prove that the new position is needed. So that's just going to take some time. The other major kind of step that was announced is that they're going to be changing the way that the consultants are billing. So they called it a project-based billing system. So like I said before, right now it is very general and very broad. And they want to move to a place where it's, you know, they look at a specific project and they say, hey, we're going to need a consultant on it. So we're going to assign someone to that. And only they can bill for that project. So you know, I think adding a little bit more accountability, hopefully cutting down on some of these contracts. I mean, I know Councilmember Moreno, that's a big thing for her because, again, I mean, over 90% of our regulatory budget is going to these consultants when, you know, the argument is that it could be done a lot cheaper in-house. So those were the major things announced today. And then there was some discussion, you know, about long-term. Where do we want to eventually get? And I don't think that a firm decision has been made on that, again, because this is just a long-term process. But anything up to basically, you know, the most extreme option being that the city, the Council Utilities Regulatory Office, does all the work except for issues at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is kind of more specialized work. But that would bring, you know, over 90% of the work that the city does in regulation into the city for, you know, full-time paid city employees.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Bonnet Carey Spillway has been open for more than 80 days in total this year. And trillions of gallons of water from the river is making its way through Lake Pontchartrain to the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I went to Waveland, Mississippi to meet with Mayor Mike Smith. Mayor Smith, what kind of environmental impacts have you seen along the coast?
You know, what we first started noticing, of course, was dolphins, and the bigger game fish was just washing up. Many turtles, many of the Ridley sea turtles who, you know, are endangered. So that was really the first signs that there was an issue. And so shortly thereafter, Biloxi Mayor Fofo Gilich had called an emergency meeting in Biloxi of all the coast mayors, and I think the 10 of the 11 were there at that meeting with their representatives too. And so Dr. Moby.
That's Dr. Moby Solange, Executive Director of the Institute for Marine Mammal Studies.
He got up and spoke. And the sad part is everything he said was, you know, would open your eyes. It was eye-opening because he said that it's wiping out our big fish population, but also it's the larvae of the shrimp. It's the larvae of the crabs. And, of course, one of our most things down here is the oysters. And the larvae from the oysters, it's just wiped out the oyster population down here.
Yeah, I read that some shrimp or crabs or some other fish can move to, you know, water that's higher salinity, but the oysters, because of the way they grow, they're stuck. So they literally can't go anywhere. And as that fresh water comes in, they just die. And that affects the ecosystem, but also that industry here in Mississippi, the seafood industry.
Exactly right. And see, the crabs come into the shoreline and into the marshy areas to lay their eggs. And then they leave and go back out to deeper water, but they're not making it back to the deeper water. And same way with the shrimp, as they come into the marshy areas and they lay their eggs, and they are getting caught up in that fresh water. Because, you know, mostly within this time, this last opening of the Bonnet Carey, it had wiped out all of the salinity in the water. We had a zero salinity in Hancock County, and mostly across the coast. You know, of course, I know when they open a Bonnet Carey, it comes down through Lake Pontchartrain. So that huge Lake Pontchartrain and Lake Bourne is all those spawn areas are being killed, and which is having a grossly negative effect on, you know, not just our seafood industry, but the people who try to get that seafood to the table.
The Bonnet Carey was built to relieve strain on the levees protecting New Orleans during periods of high river levels, but the water, even if you divert it, it has to go somewhere, and right now it's impacting you. So while we're saving those levees, we're having an impact somewhere else. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Actually, I have a lot of thoughts, and as we meet with groups of folks, last week we were in D.C. to talk about this very subject. One of the main issues that I've seen, kind of sad too, is that there's three core districts that affect the Gulf Coast. Really big impacts, and that is the New Orleans District, the Vicksburg District, and the Mobile District. Well, the New Orleans District, as of a month ago, had already spent over $92 billion on the levee system, you know, building and maintaining it to protect New Orleans. And I'm all for that. You know, maybe it's something as simple as building levees a little bit higher, adding a layer to it to where you can increase the flood levels at New Orleans. But also, the last time the river, Mississippi River, was dredged was many, many years ago. And so I think that if the Corps could go and muck out that river and make it deeper, where it should be like 90 feet all the way down through, is in some spots very shallow, but in which very shallow doesn't hold very many cubic feet of water. So if they could muck it out and add capacity to it, that would help our situation greatly. But I think that what needs to happen in the immediate term is to, for all three of those districts to speak to each other. And that's what we're asking for as coast leaders, that all three districts talk to each other and let us have a seat at the table too. Not that we're gonna make any decisions, but at least get our opinion. There are some other things, the Morganza could relieve some of it. And I think that we need to look at other flood control structures going up the Mississippi River that could relieve a little bit of part as it comes down here.
Mm-hmm. So as the Mississippi, you know, we've had this extraordinary weather, lots and lots of rain and flooding in the Midwest that is all draining into the river. You're suggesting that instead of relying on the Bonnet Carry, which is really like the last spillway on the river, look at other options or possible solutions farther upriver to relieve the impact down here.
Well, yeah, and I say that because, you know, the water that is out in our Gulf and the water that's in Lake Pontchartrain right now as we speak is riddled with pesticides and chemicals coming from the farming lands up in Idaho and Ohio. And I know that the biggest part of the chemical base in the river is coming from I believe it's Ohio. And so with that, along with all the sewage that is pumped in it, we're ending up, in essence, a cesspool here on the coast. And one other thought that we had in D.C. was to, instead of directing it to come straight out to our Gulf, to have it go out further into the 5,000 and 6,000 and 7,000 feet depth waters. You probably just put a diversion wall to run it further out than coming straight for us.
So basically, put those volumes of fresh water into a bigger volume of salt water to sort of balance that salinity issue a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I'll even say this is that. We none of us want tropical storms or hurricanes, but a mild tropical storm would at least push some of that salt water inland for us, and it would, kind of mix with the totally unsalinitized water, and so maybe it would equal it out, because oysters need at least 10 parts per thousand to live, and they're struggling at that. It was last. At the beginning of this week, it was zero here. It was zero in Pasterstown. It was 5 parts per thousand over in Gulfport. One of the issues is that if you look from our beach out toward where the Barrier Islands is, you're looking at 10 or 12 foot depths. So, once fresh water gets in, it's hard to get that out with the salt water.
What's the salinity normally along the Gulf?
It's normally above 25, 26, 27, around that area there. And then everybody's happy because, our ecosystem here is much like the marsh in Louisiana, where, just fresh water doesn't work. It has a too high salt level. So a little brackish water is mixed in with it just normally through the river. And that equals out a good spawning ground. But that has since wiped away, and from what I understand, it's going to take a long time to recover.
You said recently that you think changes to the protocol for opening the spillway should be explored, basically because the data that they use is decades old. What do you think those changes might look like?
The laws that they're going off of, or the protocols, were put in place in the 40s and the 50s. So it's time to take another look at that. And I do know that the Corps of Engineers is going to do a 2 to 3 year study on that spillway, on the effects of that spillway. And like I said, though, you still have the three districts who don't talk to each other. And so if they would just get together and have a conversation, and for the coast to pick out a representative from the coast to have a seat at that table, not to make any decisions, but at least they would, you know, key that person in on what decisions are being made and why. And so that we would all know, hey, why is this occurring? Why is the Morganza not opening? Why is there no other diversion points along the Mississippi River? So I think that all those things now, and we speak together as one voice on the coast. And I think that the trip we took to D.C. last week, it really put some sound behind what we were trying to say. Because our governor was up there at that point, and he was proclaiming an emergency. And the federal senators from Mississippi were there in support of that proclamation. So all we want is a seat at the table, a voice in what's going on, and to say, you know, hey, we think that you need to do studies quicker, provide the information to the public so that the people who depend off of that for their livelihood will know constantly what's going on.
Mayor Mike Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday, and please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.